try to go for 1 hour, under 1 hour. So if you can talk, you know, 20 minutes, do a little presentation on DevSecOps, that would be wonderful. I mean, you know, it's highly flexible. Every person does things differently. So whatever you're willing to share, we will take. We could redo the event tomorrow and the event would be different, probably.
Right, absolutely. No, what I'm going to do is try to stick to 20, 25 minutes of slides, and then we'll go into more questions and see if there's more questions. I have more slides just as needed to do a deeper dive if they want to know more about specific subject.
Awesome. All right, take it away. We are good to go. It's 10:01, and I think we have a quorum.
So, Nicolas, again, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk to my students. So I have classes on cybersecurity, and I try to bring in as many guest speakers as I can so that students of mine can learn about cybersecurity, different aspects of security, anything that is IT related. So as you know, Dean Burton has been assisting with setting up this event. Please allow me to thank you again for setting this up. And Tina, would you like to say a few words before we get started?
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Picard, and we welcome you very much, Nicholas. Appreciate your time today. As Dr. Picard mentioned, we've had a wide variety of speakers, so it's always exciting to have someone in the soft dev area. We don't have a lot of those, and I know some of our faculty here joined today specifically because of your topic. So we're really excited to hear from you. You can take it away.
Awesome, thank you. Well, I guess just to give you a little bit of a background, I'm Nick Shalom, I'm the Chief Software Officer of the Air Force. I'm also the co-lead of the DoD Enterprise DevSecOps Initiative with DoD CIO. So everything we do is DoD-wide. As you can imagine, you know, timeliness and the ability to move at the pace of relevance is critical for our weapon systems, space systems, business systems. Everything I'm going to talk about today is touching every aspect of the DoD's mission, from nuclear systems to jets, bombers, ships, submarines, and so on. So this is going to be exciting. First, for everyone, we are open sourcing and sharing a lot of the DevSecOps initiative work across DoD. And if you want to learn more, on that slide, you can see the software.ev.mil website. That's where we have a lot of the DevSecOps critical information. And you're going to find videos and training and a lot of great content there. So I highly recommend that teams go and take a look at all the source code and the architecture document and a lot of training videos and more information on DevSecOps as well. So the DevSecOps initiative, and for people that don't know what DevSecOps is, it's Dev, Development, Security, and Operations. And it's really removing the walls and breaking the walls to ensure that we can move at a pace of relevance. We can rapidly push software to production multiple times a day, as often as needed, really. And that really came from some of the large organizations on the commercial side, teams like Netflix and Google and so on, are releasing, you know, millions now of updates, really a week, a day. And that is really how you keep up with, you know, the competition and really also addressing cyber issues as well. Some of the foundation around the DevSecOps for us was to make sure we would not be vendor locked to a specific cloud or infrastructure or platform. And so we picked Kubernetes, which is open source, came from Google and became part of the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. And Kubernetes is an orchestration stack that orchestrates containers. And we'll talk about containers today and why they matter. Containers, you can think of them as shipping containers for software, where you can put a little bit of software into a container and that can be immutable, that can be shipped into a different environment, and they can run agnostic to the kind of environment, if it's on the cloud, if it's on the jet, if it's on a classified system, we can run these same containers across the entire department. The first aspect for us, and since you care about cyber, that's going to resonate with you guys, was to make sure that one is we would have centralized artifact repo of container. And really that is how we end up centrally scanning and hardening the containers so we can understand the risk of each of these containers. That can be both open source, but also commercial products. And that allows us to centrally update them. So no more chasing updates and manually updating software. This is all highly automated, directly in partnership with the companies providing software to the DoD and the open source community as well. But then we also, part of the SEC of DevSecOps for us, it's not just, hey, we're going to do some static dynamic code analysis on our source code. The SEC piece is the zero trust continuous monitoring stack and behavior detection stack. So we have the concept of a sidecar container. So a sidecar container, for people that don't know what a sidecar is a small container running alongside all the containers. And the beauty of that is injected by Kubernetes. So it's always going to run no matter who built the container. We're always going to get the same cyber capability, the same stack, the same ability to control traffic across containers. So I can deny all the traffic and whitelist traffic for container A talk to B. It has to be whitelisted. So that reduced the attack surface if a bad actor was to be able to get access to one of the containers. But at the same time, that's also how we continuously monitor the stack. And if we find drift in behavior using AI machine learning, we can now kill proactively the container and go back to immutable state. So it makes it very hard for a bad actor to laterally move across the system and find the crown jewels and be able to persist in the system. We'll talk also about why having enterprise IT capabilities. And we created two teams for us, Cloud One and Platform One. Cloud One is our cloud office, and Platform One is our DevSecOps managed team, and why they matter and why this is the only way to scale when talent is rare. And then we're going to talk about how important continuous learning is. And since you're learning right now, you understand that more than most. It is very difficult for universities and pretty much anyone doing any type of training out there to keep up with the pace of IT. And when you look at curriculums and you look at different trainings we see, we often struggle to keep up with you know, what's going on the commercial side. Often you have five to 10 years sometimes behind and we enable teams to have that self-learning, continuous learning environment as a training hub, completely online and using a cloud so they can have a sandbox so they don't learn in a vacuum. And so I have 100,000 people I have to train this year. So it's a small team of 100,000 people. And we have to really bring that self-learning. And for that, we wanted to bring unbiased content from the Linux Foundation, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and O'Reilly, the IT books. And so we partnered and we created this learning hub, which really brought to life kind of the entire O'Reilly training content. And that provides not only, you know, DevSecOps great content, but also data science and pretty much anything you can think about around IT and even more than IT, also in management and project management and stuff like that. When you think of the layers of DevSecOps and you're thinking of the different to enable reuse, you want to have that infrastructure layer. And for us, that could be a cloud, that could be a classified cloud, that could be on premise on the jet, on a space system, whatever. And so we first abstract that infrastructure layer, and then we're going to put Kubernetes on top of that. Kubernetes, we support multiple distributions of Kubernetes with OpenShift, you know, VMware, Rancher, D2iQ Convoy. So plenty of options. Multiple companies can provide a supported Kubernetes distribution. And then we bring the continuous integration, continuous delivery pipeline, the DevSecOps pipeline on top, which brings all the containers, and we'll show the complexity of that in the next few slides. On top of that, we have what we call a service mesh. And that's another great example. Service meshes didn't even exist maybe 3 years ago, and now they are foundational to the success of development teams and security teams. And really, when you look at curriculums out there, I bet most of them, you know, don't even mention service meshes. And yet for us, we would not even be able to succeed or scale without a service mesh. So that tells you, you know, 3 years is kind of now what it takes between obsolescence and success. And so it's a very, very short turnaround. And honestly, you know, I'm talking about 3 years, but already the real adoption of a service mesh started maybe 2 years ago. So it's really a 2 year cycle. And by using a service mesh, which manages the east and west traffic between containers. So container A talk to B has to be whitelisted, but really that DevSecOps initiative really enables, and the service mesh piece enables that zero trust enforcement. We'll talk about what that means as well. And then the application layer inherits all these layers and, you know, 95% of the NIST, the cyber controls, you know, 853, and really very few are left. And that really empowers the team to focus on building their mission software while not having to really think about cyber, but cyber being baked in and injected into the stack, providing the a lot of the top cyber capability. We talk about zero trust, we talk about behavior detection. So the concept of a service mesh using a sidecar container, the sidecar is game changing because the sidecar is a small container that runs alongside all of the containers and they are dynamically injected, right? So I don't have to recompile my container. I can inject that cyber capability across the stack. And I know that no matter what container is going to be running, no matter who built that container, I'm going to get the same cyber capability and the same visibility and enforcement. It hijacks the IP table, so it creates kind of some type of a reverse proxy, so I can inject a mutual TLS tunnel, so all the traffic is encrypted, no matter if the team even thought about encryption or not. I can inject that behavior detection. I can inject that zero trust enforcement, so the proxy will deny all traffic and only accept whitelisted traffic. And so a lot of the key capabilities that we use on the cyber side all thanks to this stack. But also we are using the concept of moving target defense in cyber, which is about treating your containers as cattle, not as pet, as we call it. Cattle means you just shoot it behind the barn and you kill it as often as you want or you can, multiple times a day, ideally, versus a pet, like a virtual machine that you care and you don't want the stuff to go down. That is an obsolete way of thinking. Now we want to kill stuff rapidly and go back to immutable state so there is no drift in production and everything is code. And we'll talk about infrastructure as code and GitOps as well. So the next step is why it matters to have this enterprise team. And really that's where Platform One becomes that central team that feeds all the development teams across the DoD and provide that enterprise service across the department. We have multiple teams across the US that are feeding into that. But really on top of that, I wanted to share now another slide deck where I'm gonna bring up a couple of other slides that can help you drive into deeper into the service mesh and cyber, particularly because I know obviously you guys care about cyber. What I can do is take a pause and see if there is any question. And if not, I'm just going to bring up the new slide deck I have right here and keep going with more slides. Any questions?
No questions at this time, I think.
Not yet.
All right, you're going to have plenty after this other slide. So let me bring this right now. Here we go. Share. Okay. So this one is a deeper dive into the cyber side of things. And a lot of people ask us, you know, why did you pick Kubernetes and containers? Well, we talk about the abstraction, so we're not locked in. So we abstracted, so we don't depend on a specific cloud or technology stack. Containers are immutable. They can be centrally accredited and hardened. But then Kubernetes brings a ton of benefit too. We have that resiliency because if containers crash, they can self-heal and restore automatically. But the most important piece is that baked-in security with the automated injection of the sidecar stack. So Kubernetes will automatically launch sidecar containers when we launch new containers. and our cyber stack can be embedded into that automatically. And no matter what container is running, we get the same visibility, we get the logs, we get the zero trust enforcement, the behavior detection, and so on. But also you're very adaptable, right? Because all these containers are kind of Lego blocks that can be swapped. And because of Kubernetes, you have no downtime when you upgrade or when you change swap containers. So you can use modern routing to make sure that if you're trying things out and you're deploying a new piece of software, a new update, there is no impact to your productivity and your production workload, and there's no downtime. And then the key foundation of DevSecOps is around the infrastructure as code and GitOps model, where everything is code. So there's no one connecting in SSH into a Linux server and typing commands and patching the system. It is all in code. So cyber guys have to completely reinvent themselves into developers because at the end of the day, that change that they have to make the system patched and updated, is not going to be on SSH typing commands. It's going to be in the Git repo as a source code change that will trigger the pipeline, which will run the tests, run the cyber scans, and be able then to be deployed in production and with complete automation, right? And we control change management by having multiple set of eyes on code. So, you know, you define how many people have to approve a code change for the change to go into staging and then into production as well. And so that is the foundation of the automation. So that's how we end up treating the system as cattle and not pets. So in effect, what that means is we can easily kill the entire system overnight and bring it back every morning. And we know we have the exact same stack because we don't let drift happen in production. Everything is in code. Of course, Kubernetes also brings auto-scaling. So that enables teams to be able to scale up and down the stack if there's more need of compute or memory. And that gives a lot of flexibility as well. When you look at a DevSecOps pipeline, that's just an example of a pipeline. We have way more containers. We have 200 plus containers on DevSecOps, 16 programming languages, 23 databases. If you have to run this stack that you see here in dev, test, staging, and production, and you're doing this across multiple classification level for us, so you end up having 20 of these stacks to manage per team. If you were to run these as virtual machines, you would get so far behind, you have a tough time keeping up with updates and stuff like that. So using containers is really critical there. And the containers will be able to be pushed across environments. So we know it's going to be exactly the same version, the same stack running across dev, test, staging, and prod, and across classification levels. And we get to push these containers every 4 hours. So if there is an update, it's going to self-update every 4 hours. If there is no update, we still kill the container and then we go back to its immutable state. So if there was a bad actor in the system, by definition, it's just lost everything it just did because you went back to immutable state. You went back to the original state of the container 4 hours ago. And so there's no persistent capability for the bad actor to remain in the system and then laterally move. Plus, because we use zero trust, even if it could talk to another container, it would only be able to talk to a subset of the system, which means you end up limiting and reducing your attack surface. If your crown jewel becomes your software lifecycle, right? And so you're right. If they get into your Git repo, for example, which becomes your crown jewel because that's your source of truth, everything is in code. So if someone were to be able to get into your source code repo, that's why we sign code, and that's why we have multi-factor authentication. And that's why we have multiple set of eyes to approve code change. So not one person can make a code change to also mitigate insider threat. But if someone were to be able to get into your DevSecOps stack, and that's why we treat the DevSecOps stack itself as cattle too. And that's why we use even containers to build the DevSecOps pipeline. So in effect, the software factory itself is also built using the same principle. Then we also mitigate that risk because we also limit what the tools can do and the kind of changes that can be made. And so we reduce that kind of risk as well. But if they were to get access to the entire stack, of course, that DevSecOps platform, they would be able to tamper with the software and then inject potentially malicious things in the system. So that would be a big issue. So really your crown jewel becomes your DevSecOps pipeline. So we talked about that. When we built the platform and services, and it's very important for teams to understand, we wanted to bring options, right? And it, one size fits all doesn't work. We need options. And so what we end up doing is making sure we provide enterprise services. And so we have to select some options, but we always want to have more than one and not have a one size fits all mindset. But there are a few things that everybody needs, like a source code repo. So we created Repo One, which is open source, where we have all the containers and the Kubernetes distributions and the infrastructure as code automation. We use Terraform, so we're not locked into a cloud provider. And then we have Iron Bank, which is the binary side of that, where we have the signed containers and the signed bits. And really, then we have two main models, the Party Bus and the Big Bang. As you can see, we have pretty cool names. I mean, look at the logo we have. Is that a cool logo? Smokey the Bear and tying back to Baby Yoda. I mean, that's pretty cool. My lawyers love me. But Party Bus is the multi-tenant environment where we are providing the DevSecOps stack as a turnkey option, and teams can just be onboarded as a developer, and they get access to multiple classification levels. They get access to a subset of tools we pick based on demand of the customers, and it's kind of a shared environment versus the Big Bang, which is a dedicated enclave for a larger team like F-35 or GBSD, which is all the nuclear programs on the ground. And that is using the Big Bang. And that is more customized, and they get to pick the tools and stuff like that. Then when it comes to training, and again, you know, I can insist more that continuous learning is the only way to remain relevant in IT. And I'm not just saying that because I didn't go to school and because I was self-taught when I created my company back in France when I was 15. I'm 36 now, so it's been 21 years, I guess. But really, it is all about keeping up with the pace of the commercial industry. And so we brought quite a few options. The learning hub we talked about, then we have kind of 1 day, 3 day sessions to onboard some of our people. But then we have the full 2 months minimal viable product to be able to onboard a team and embed people of Platform One into the team so they can get started rapidly and build an MVP within 2 months in production so they can see what DevSecOps really means with the actual tangible delivery of capability to the real end user and not just in the lab. I'm gonna do one more slide and then we'll see if there's more questions, but the microservice architecture with Istio is foundational. We talked about it. The importance of that is once you move from a monolithic architecture of a big, a fat, as we call it, application, and you're moving to microservices and smaller code base, one, you're mitigating risk because not everyone needs to have access to every microservice, so less people will be able to know how the entire system functions. But also, you can decouple your releases and you can release microservices at their own pace. So you can completely decouple your releases per microservice. But at the same time, back in the day, if you didn't have a service mesh, you would have to coordinate libraries that have to be shared across teams, particularly across programming languages between, if you use Python, Java, Go, C, whatever, they have to share libraries to authenticate, to do encryption, to do load balancing, to do service discovery. Now with a service mesh, that's decoupled and managed by a separated sidecar proxy that runs alongside, not inside the container. And so that is game changing because even if a bad actor would get access to the container, on a VM use case, they would tamper with the agent running and cheat the logs, and then you wouldn't see what's going on anymore. In a container, even if they get inside the container, they would have to get it through the entire container orchestration stack to be able to tamper with what the sidecar can still see inside that container because it's running alongside, not inside the container, right? So that brings a lot of separation of duties and all the good stuff, but it also decouples how you do authentication, encryption, load balancing. For example, I don't care if my teams use encryption between containers because my service mesh will inject a mutual TLS tunnel and create strong identities using X509 certificates across the entire stack. So that manages all my role-based access control, all my east-west traffic, whitelisting, and all that kind of stuff. All the load balancing, all the routing, and so you can do a lot of pretty cool stuff. And you don't have to coordinate releases between the languages and the teams. So that really enables you to move to have each team move at their own pace. Very critical piece. I'm going to pause here and see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Nicholas. I have a question. How do you do certification and accreditation, or rather ANA right now, for something like that, which is not static?
Yeah, so I have a whole slide on that, so we can jump on that. I just wanted to address one question also I see on the chat, because that's tied to this before we move to the accreditation piece. Change management, right? Change management, agile doesn't mean you just go and wing stuff around and you hope for the best. Change management, of course, in the former way, when we used to, call of a change management board and all that stuff is gone, and that's outdated and obsolete. But it doesn't mean you don't do change management, right? You need to understand your dependencies, your bit of material, what's running, who has access to what, and how many set of eyes you have on code. If you look at SpaceX, for a code to be approved to go to production, which they can update the day before the launch, they need to have 3 set of eyes to approve the code. That's what I call change management, right? What that means is it's all through merge requests and pull requests in the Git repo. So it's not a manual. I mean, it is, I guess, manual. You have to go and click yes or no. But it is not like an old school board that means once a month. It's on the source code repo. You can go and see the change. You can see the code change. You can approve it. And then, teams can decide, do I have 1 approver, 2 approvers? So based on the criticality, when you start doing space stuff, nuclear stuff, I'm sure you would like us to have more than 1 approver, and that's what we do. So that's really how we do our change management.
Right? So are you talking about cross-functional teams?
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. So it depends, right? It depends on what the change is. For example, I have a infrastructure team that does all the Terraform automation stuff. I have a Kubernetes team that does all the Kubernetes changes, which really is critical, because if they tamper with Kubernetes, they can tamper with my entire cyber stack, and they can even remove my sidecar container and remove a bunch of stuff. And I have a service mesh team that does a whitelisting of traffic between container A and B. And then each container has its own repo as well, with its own change management too, for that 1 microservice, 1 container. And so when you end up having all these different layers, you have different type of approval. And sometimes it's a separate team. Like, for example, if container A team says, I want to whitelist to container B, not only container B needs to be okay with that, but then the service mesh team needs also to be okay with that. So it's 2 approvers, right? So that's how we end up doing our enforcement to make sure we mitigate insider threat or just mistakes, right? It doesn't have to be malicious. But yeah, that's also what we do for any. So that's why I call it change management, not the old school change management board that meets once a month, or this can be multiple times a day as needed, right? So now let me go back to your question about the. I don't know if I have the slide on this slide, but I can find it. I have a slide specifically on the accreditation, but let me explain. First, back in the day when we used to do our ATOs, we used to really spend a very lengthy amount of time, about 8 to 12 months to be able to go through the process to accredit a piece of software. And then there was a concept called fast track authority to operate. So fast track ATO, where you take a piece of software and you automate the generation of the artifacts needed to approve the software to go into production. That's great, but that's not really scale. I mean, that scales, but that scaled to a point because you still have to go and explain, how the container is being assessed, and each piece of software has to be well documented, and that creates a lot of work. So what we ended up doing is a whole different concept called a continuous ATO, continuous authority to operate. And the continuous ATO is very different. It is about accrediting first the platform. So if I go back to the slides on the layers, here we go. we created the platform first, which has a cyber stack that we talked about. That's great for the runtime piece. It's going to do the behavior detection. It's going to do the zero trust enforcement. And so first we created that. Then we created the process of the CI/CD pipeline. That's this piece here where we're going to define gates between change management gates, testing gates, and cyber gates. What that means is we're going to define how many set of eyes on code we want for that project, how much test coverage, so unit testing, integration testing, end-to-end testing, what percentage of tests of our code do we want to have covered by test. You know, critical system will go as high as 100%. 100% of the code has to be unit tested and integration tested. And then we have cyber gates, where you have static, dynamic code analysis findings, container security scanning, a bit of material scanning, so we know dependencies of dependencies and risk associated with that. So those all will be the gates. And then we define values for these gates. And if your software passes those gates and runs on that accredited platform as a container, now your software is accredited. And now we also train the team that's going to be using, because there's a large piece also that's people driven. And so we're going to accredit and verify that the team has the clearance and all the things they need in terms of knowledge and expertise to be able to use this to not try to cheat the system. And so we have a training session where the team is onboarded to then be able to use that stack. So now that team is able to use the continuous ATO to release software. That's how we do the continuous assessment and accreditation of the software, by continuously scanning the code and checking those gates. And if the code builds and compiles and passes the tests, then it can be deployed to staging and then production. Does that make sense?
Yes, sorry, I was on mute.
Any other questions? Let's see. Should I just read the questions in the chat, or are you picking them for me, or whichever?
Let me just read.
It looks like there's a few questions there in the chat. Joe was asking if the DoD SCA community will be training anytime soon on this process.
Sorry, there was an echo. I couldn't hear what you just said. Sorry, I apologize.
Oh, sorry. The question was, is if the DoD SCA community will be training anytime on this process soon?
Yes. So I'm the chair of the DSOG, the DoD Security Authorization Working Group for DevSecOps for the DoD. And so I have 11 teams working different things. One of the team is actually creating that continuous ATO guidance that's going to be released by the end of the year. And that documentation comes with training for the SCAS and the ISSMs and AOs to be able to go and accredit and learn how to do these continuous ATO assessments. That will come with training. We're piloting the training with some teams to see the feedback we're getting. But there will be official guidance coming out, I would say around November 15th, maybe end of November, based on coordination. And then the training piece will come with it. Absolutely.
So is this something that you're planning to deploy to other groups other than just the DevOps groups that you lead, or?
Yeah, it's going to be a DoD-wide option. They have to abide and follow these rules and the stuff we talked about. We have a DoD Enterprise DevSecOps Reference Design that they have to follow, and then they have to follow the continuous ATO guidance. And if they do, then technically they all, I guess, DevSecOps Pathfinders or programs, and then they can use that continuous ATO to release software as needed multiple times a day or once a month or whatever they need.
Go
ahead.
Nicholas, thanks for coming. Are you going to be in this presentation? Because I have a couple questions, but if you're going to cover it a little bit later, then I'll save my questions. But are you going to talk about your development and testing workforce and the skills that you look for, maybe the frustrations that you have today with your developers? Because as a past developer, spending 28 years in industry, and now being a professor, trying to teach some software development and, of course, cybersecurity. I'm interested in those kind of things.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have a specific slide on that, but I'm happy to answer now. So, I mean, obviously, there is talent gaps, and quite honestly, it has everything to do with setting expectations in terms of continuous learning. For example, I give an hour a day to my team to go and learn on the training hub so they can keep up and first catch up, because many are not even current, and then they have to, you know, keep learning because things are moving very fast. I can tell you, I don't believe that sending someone, you know, a month or 2 weeks or whatever to some place to learn is making any significant difference long term, because one is the pace of IT and learning has changed so drastically in the last few months or years that you end up having to know and learn how to self learn. And if you can't do that, I just don't know if you're going to be able to succeed. So the learning ability becomes almost more important than your existing technical skills. So the ability to learn fast and by yourself with some help, right? I'm not saying you have to do it all alone, but mostly driven by you willing to be able to learn and do it, right? A lot of people are just afraid of learning. You know, when I hear, you know, DevSecOps or DevOps, the culture is hard, but the text is easy. That's nonsense. Usually people that sit out are not very technical and they don't actually understand how hard the tech is. But actually, the culture is hard because the tech is hard. Right. If the tech was easy, culture would be actually much easier and people would be embracing it. What's scary for people is that, wait, it's a complete change of what I know, and I'm not willing to do that, so I'm going to put it away and blame culture, when really it's nothing to do with the culture. It's everything to do with the learning and the ability to completely reinvent yourself. I mean, if you look at the cyber stuff, what I described today, where we're moving from, I'm gonna type command on SSH in command line and do patching and scanning and stuff like that, to a source code world where I have to patch in code and run through a pipeline. For a cyber professional, that's a complete drastic, complete change of what they know, right? The tools, the language, I mean, they don't code. Most of them, you know, do barely any bash script or stuff like that, right? So there's a lot of learning that has, and then, oh, Kubernetes and containers, and we have all these new fancy titles with site reliability engineers and DevSecOps engineers. That's completely changing the way we even think of the silos. We're breaking the silos, shifting people left. Testing becomes a part of a full stack developer. I mean, you look at SpaceX, right? It's very interesting to me that they only have 200 people for the entire software team that builds the entire software stack of SpaceX, 11 platforms plus the boat, you know, catching the rocket back and all the stuff they do, 200 people. And yet we have 4,000 developers on F-35 alone, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. And then if you compound that to the fact that all of these 200 developers are full stack engineers, they don't have special, really, you know, dedicated specialty. They move around in a lot of different things. They do some testing one day, and then maybe the next week they're going to do some cyber scanning and assessment of open source capabilities. And so that's also changing the way we're thinking of talent and hiring and job descriptions and pretty much everything we know. And so shifting left, you know, people say, you know, is hard. It is hard because it's about learning and changing what people know.
Okay. Thank you.
And so I guess some of the frustration I have with the team is obviously we need to scale much faster than what we are moving at. And so 100,000 people is obviously a lot. Many of them are pretty stuck, even let alone on the cloud stuff, but even like virtualization stuff. So it's pretty basic stuff that really has been widely adopted on the commercial side for the last 10, 15 years. And yet we still see people getting excited by VMs, right? So we're trying to have them jump all the way to containers and serverless and function as a service and stuff like that. But again, if you look at the pace, it's just completely insane. So people that could not learn and were used to that pace of a 5-10 year learning time down to now 1-2 years, that's a drastic change. Many people won't be willing to take that kind of time, because that time often has to be after hours, right? Not many companies will give you what I give, 1 hour a day, let alone any hours. So then you have to learn on your own, and that puts even more stress in your life. And it has to be continuous. It cannot just be this one-time thing. You're sent somewhere 1 year and spend 2 weeks somewhere and learn some things. Right. It's not the way it's going to work anymore.
Yeah, I'm a proponent of kind of cross training. You know, you have a developer, then like you said, put them in system tests, you know, run some regression tests, load tests, then go put them even in technical support and let them understand, you know, what the customers are saying, and then eating their own dog food too, I found very, very valuable. Now, do you think with your stack that you've put a lot of provisions in it for security and whatnot, of course, but do you think some of the things you did was also because some of the developers were not disciplined in, say, perhaps using secure coding standards that have been around forever? So I see that you built in a lot of stuff to maybe help with that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's defense in depth, right? Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's first the defense in depth aspect of, look, we have to think about insider threat, whether it's, you know, right, malicious people or just people that are not, like you said, qualified or make mistakes. But then also we want to start thinking zero trust mindset. And so right, by definition, I don't trust anything. I'm not going to trust any layer. I'm going to have multiple redundant layers of security, but then I also want to make sure I don't trust people, right? And yeah, so that's why I changed my multiple set of eyes, all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that moving target defense of killing stuff every 4 hours and bringing it back to immutable state, that's a great way to make sure people are not cheating the system, right? Because if they go in production, make a change in SSH, and I kill it in 4 hours and it goes back to immutable state and everything they've done is gone, I can tell you they're going to stop connecting and typing commands, right? So they're going to go back to source code and push that change the normal way with the pipeline. And so that also helps push the culture change and enforce the rules. But you're right. I think it's certainly a big reason as to why we're bringing a lot of this stuff is to make sure that, you know, trust but verify.
Right, right. Understand. So from what you would like to see us educators do in our curriculum, let's say we're teaching, you know, about software design and architecture, and, you know, then later on, you know, different programming languages and implementation, and then different kinds of tests. Do you agree that security should be talked about and baked in through the entire curriculum that may produce, let's say, a software engineer or a software developer?
Absolutely. Oh yeah. So you know, what's funny for me with my background is I'm a developer, but I'm a cyber guy too. So I always try to find the middle ground between both. And the reason why I call the initiative DevSecOps, not DevOps, which was the name when I started 2 years ago in DoD, and I renamed it to DevSecOps, is, and not SecDevOps, which was what some people wanted. I call it DevSecOps for two reasons. One is security has to be baked in. It's not first. It's not first because security is never what you do first. If you don't even know what you're building, or you don't, and by the way, if you want to be secure, just turn off your laptop and go to the beach and you're very safe, right? If you want to be innovating, which is the prime driver as to why you're doing this kind of stuff, and you want to deliver new capabilities, you want to have that cyber security baked in. That's a whole different mindset, right? People that just are so centered on their own cyber jobs that think they are so important, they are the first piece of the stack and it should be called SecDevOps. Those people are the toxic people, right? Because they think, because I'm a cyber guy, cyber is the most important. No, it is not. It's never going to be the most important in anything, even for nuclear systems, right? Safety is, right? Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, if the bomb doesn't detonate, you did nothing, right? I mean, so it has the main piece is delivering the capability you want to deliver, right? And so if you can keep up with changes, or you have issues where China or Russia are able to find 0 days and you can patch your system or update your stack fast enough, and now you're at cyber risk because of your lack of timeliness. Timeliness could actually be more impactful to your cybersecurity than all the cyber capabilities in the world, right? So if you can be, you know, keep up with that type of pace in your updates, you put yourself more at risk, often because of stupid compliance requirements and paperwork, right? So I care about the real cybersecurity. I care about the real cyber capabilities, and I want it baked in and part of the process. And a lot of, you know, when you look at developers, it's really true that many of them completely ignore cyber. So of course you want to improve the training and curriculum, but the fact is, even with that, I will still have the gates because I won't trust it, right? And I want to have those multiple layers of security as well.
Yeah, no, I understand. A lot of developers, you know, they don't know what a 0 day is. I mean, they're still concentrating on delivering, the functionality that they were tasked to do. And so, Yeah. Okay.
And there's more to it too, right? It's also where we have a large gap of talent, back to your question also on frustration. Abstraction and basic understanding of microservices versus monolithic application stacks, strangler pattern, all the stuff we teach in our curriculums on how to take a monolithic application, turn it into microservices, decouple yourself so you're not locked into a specific stack, you're not locked into a technology that's going to become obsolete within a couple of years, so you can be abstracted. They always take shortcuts and take the easy route, whether it's using cloud services, which, you know, only works on one cloud, and now you're stuck to that one cloud, where you could have abstracted it, you know, using basic abstraction principles. And we do that with Kubernetes, right? Kubernetes is an abstraction API. You talk to Kubernetes, Kubernetes talks to the cloud and gets you compute storage and load balancing and all the stuff you need. And that's how we can scale and be agnostic and elastic, and yet still benefit from all the good stuff that the cloud providers can bring. But having in mind and understanding the cost and the complexity of vendor lock-in, I think that's the second piece, right? That you talk about the cyber piece. The other piece is the architecture, lack of training on cloud native architecture.
So Nicola, let me ask you a question. When I was working with DFOS at Hanscom, I embedded an organization called Asakuri. I don't know if they're still around. And we actually implemented this with the modernization contractor that was working on the weapon system. And we reduced the software defects with static code analysis tools dramatically. Is that something that you're seeing implemented across the board with organizations that do first training of the tool to make sure that people keep this in mind, and then embedding some tools to make sure that, you know, you reduce the amount of efforts? Defects.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So static dynamic analysis is a mandated piece of the DevSecOps stack. I would actually say it's a mandated piece of DevOps. Most people, when they think of DevSecOps, they think, oh, we're going to do some static dynamic analysis and we're good. That is just the basic step one of cyber, right? And yeah, you're right. we didn't do it right, and we still often don't, although I think we improve drastically. But you know, static analysis goes so far, right? First, if you control the code base, okay, you can make changes. If it's open source, or if it's a COTS product, what do? You're gonna scan the stuff, you're gonna find millions of findings, many are false positives, or they're gonna claim it's false positives. I mean, look, I approve containers from all of the industry across DoD, all the way to SAP, right? Classification levels. And so when I look at findings, we had companies say, oh, you know, that's a false positive. And then they got away with it for 10 years sometimes, even including passing the IC NSA Cyber Command scans and be approved on the classified side. And when my team reviewed some of these products like GitLab and Atlassian and others, we had so many actually real findings that they had marked as false positive, they were just getting away with it. And then that's why, you know, GitLab, you know, literally hired like 12 people to go and tackle some of these 0 days that my team found, and now, you know, patched inside of GitLab now. But that tells you, right, people got away with it for years before my team. And honestly, they passed most of my team until it got to me. and you know, that's my expertise. But the fact is, we can put a limited amount of value on static kinesis, right? There's sometimes too much noise, and now you can find, you know, really what's the real meaningful stuff. But then also, if you don't control the code, you know, what do you do then? Do you not use it? And what about dependencies, right? There's so much you can scan. And if there's too many findings, it's getting tough. That's why if you do it in a pipeline, in the DevSecOps pipeline, and do it multiple times a day, you don't wait for that technical debt to compound to millions of findings. You do it every day. You're going to get a few findings. You're going to fix it. We're not going to let you pass the scans and deploy until you do. So you're not compounding that technical debt for years. That really helps, you know, provide a better quality of software. But then by also having very high test coverage, we can test software better, automate testing more. And so when you compound the two, but then really honestly, the cyber piece for us is a zero trust stack, the behavior detection. So if a bad actor gets access to one of the container, they're gonna try to type commands and do malicious stuff, and we're gonna detect that and prevent it and kill the container. That brings a ton of value as well.
So Nicolas, do you see this applying to other branches of DoD? Because I mean, it sounds fantastic, but they, you know, there's Navy, there's Army, there's other organizations. Do you see these moving?
Yeah.
Things like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, you know, this is a DoD enterprise capability. It's not an Air Force thing, although the Air Force is the executive agent. But our job is to provide it to all of the DoD. In fact, Navy and Army have plenty of teams on Platform One. We have also the Force Estate. We even have all of Cyber Command moving to Platform One. We have Transcom. I mean, you name it. Most of the big weapon systems, Joint AI Center, Jake, is on Platform One. All the ABMS, JADC2 stack, F-35, you know. So it's really starting to spread. The issue is often these teams have their own journey, and they start, you know, with micro, tiny teams moving to DevSecOps. And then they say, oh, yes, I'm doing DevSecOps. Yeah, you're doing DevSecOps on the 1,000th of your stack, so you still have a lot of room for growth. And so that's the next big push for me next year and this year, is to scale the adoption within each program, because we're touching every major program from space to nuclear to jets and bombers and weapons, all the way to the edge. But we have a tiny scale within these teams.
Should be interesting, because I think 2 weeks from now, Dr. Burton and I are trying to get General Lee from DISA to talk to students. Yeah. So it should be very interesting to see how what he has to say about this. And if, by the way, if you want to join us, you are welcome to. I can send you an invite once we set it up. We just got from his chief of staff today some answers, so we should be setting it up for 2 weeks from now, if I'm correct. Just as an FYI.
That's good to know. This site is certainly improving compared to what it used to be, so that's good.
Nicolas, and your development teams created Platform One. Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm the my team, Platform One, is responsible for accrediting all the containers in DoD as well.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. Other departments will use Platform One for different initiatives, but yet you need to maintain Platform One and improve it and make fixes and things like that. So is there sometimes some complexities that occur because, you know, you want to release updates to Platform One while, you know, it's being used? So I'm sure you have staging areas and test areas and all kind of things like that before you go to production.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, and the fact that we use containers also lets us really rotate things around and bring more Lego blocks to try new things without impacting the existing stuff. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of options. And then we have two main options, right? We have the multi-tenant environment that's shared across DoD. And then we have dedicated instance of Platform One for larger teams like F-35 or GBSD. You know, they end up having a dedicated enclave with their tools. They get to pick what's running there. They can pick from the multi-tenant environment and bring it on their environment. But the good news is we have created software centrally. We have data centrally. So all these Lego blocks are shared across DoD all the way to SAP.
Got it. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Shalon. Hey, my name is Joe Zayat. I I come from the security side of the whole thing. I work at Hill Air Force Base. I've been in a few VTCs with you with GBSD. So I'm coming from the ISM standpoint, and now I'm in the SAR role, working for Mr. Holtzman.
Great. Small so, world. Okay. Awesome.
Go ahead, sir.
Do you work with Dennis Holtzman from Hanscom?
Yes, sir.
Denny.
Yeah, oh, Denny. Small so, world. I used him at Hanscom.
Yeah.
Denny is my AO for everything we do. So.
Yeah, he's a good man. You know, in my opinion, you know, I started with GBSD about a year and a half ago. I come from a traditional ANA background, working in special programs for the last 15 years. So trying to wrap my mind around the DevSecOps methodology and trying to get us in the right direction to get us our, you know, our continuous ATO, our fast track ATO, which we got under Mr. Holtzman for our environment that, you know, we're working in now. What I'm finding though, sir, is that on the, there's just this gap, and I know it's knowledge base, and I know it's, you know, I go to these meetings, I sit in there with Kyle Fox, and Kyle Fox is 100 miles an hour about stuff, as you know. And, you know, it's for me, coming from that background, you know, the reason why I'm in the program now with Purdue is, you know, I had to learn that, okay, I've got to enhance my skill set. And if I didn't understand or learn how to understand Ansible or JSON or, you know, Python and all this stuff that these guys are doing, how can I, as ISM, you know, take that information and move it into to get an authorization? So you mentioned that there's going to be training coming out, and you know what, that's awesome. Because we in the assessment community desperately need that.
I'm tracking. I think it's no. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, you're fine, sir. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, you know, we know. I mean, it's a complete massive shift. And honestly, I think the Air Force moved a little bit too fast with some of these ATOs. And very few people were trained, right, to even understand it. And then we're at a point now where we want to scale, and we realize, wait a minute, we completely forgot to train our cyber workforce. And so I'm certainly tracking, and we have a lot of stuff that's going to come out, which I think is going to be very helpful. Although, you know, now the question is, how do you train and how do you scale that training? That's where we're going to need your help, right, to help us spread the good word, because it's a very tight, small community. But yeah, you know, when I think people understand the automation we bring, and we're not saying it's perfect, but there's plenty of room to add more layers and more information, more automation. The key is to understand, you know, are we targeting compliance or security, right? And then if we're targeting real security, then can we automate it or can we not automate it? And look, I'm not saying everything has to be automated. There's plenty of stuff that can be manual. Although we need to really understand the impact of those bottlenecks and things like that. But that's where you're right. You're changing pretty much every tool you're used to using into a more developer-centric world. But I think once they get it, they're going to see, wait, I have real-time visibility on these dashboards. And we're going to bring more dashboards. And in fact, I'm going to be mandating a DevSecOps reporting dashboard to SCAS and for SCAS and ISSMs so they can see in real-time the stack and the ingress egress port protocol, all the traffic, and see if that matches with what they had understood. And I can tell you right now, when I look at ATOs and I look at what's running on the stack and I compare a scan of the production workload with the ATO documentation, never yet I've seen an ATO that had the right ingress egress port protocol listed compared to what's actually running, right? And that tells you what's the value of that. Then if you spend a year to do that and then you have the wrong data anyway, and it drifted slowly but surely with more stuff, and that was never documented, and all the risk even assessed, right? So that's where we're going to need your help to really how do we make that as easily digestible in words that they understand, but yet they still having them make that shift from that more manual cyber compliance world to the development side of the world.
So Nicolas, do you think that it's all pretty much based on the quality of the AO? Because I mean, when you mention who is your AO, I kind of smiled and I knew that he was willing to work with you. And I'm dealing with so many AOs that are not helpful. I mean, I'm dealing with a SCAR that is pretty much declining everything because of, you know, something that is in progress, for example, and they don't understand something is progress. No, reject it, period. So if you deal pretty much with the right AO, pretty much you can have things move forward, and otherwise you're kind of stuck. So maybe the critical success is who is the AO and the SCAR.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a piece. I mean, we want to try to remove that impediment by doing better training. But right now, this is why we're even going to have a memo where we're going to actually nominate only a few AAOs that will be allowed to do Contus ATOs. So we know for a fact they're following the right guidance. Because we see the opposite, too. We see people actually approving stuff that shouldn't be approved. I can tell you I've seen crazy stuff coming out of some of the teams where they approved Contus ATOs on things that barely meet any kind of standard. And so we certainly don't want that either. So you know, there's a balance, and certainly the AO, you know, first my AO was Lauren, who is now the CIO, so she's not an AO anymore, but Danny, you know, has been involved for over a year, so that's also very helpful, but the goal, I mean, I work with 28 AOs, and they all have very well understood the value of it, but the technical piece is always tough, and then that has to spread from the AO to the SCAS and ISSMs. That is a whole different journey, and that's why the training will be so important.
Cool. Okay, I see that time is running out. Do you have a few more minutes, or shall we wrap up?
Yeah, I'm afraid I have a 2 o'clock, but I'm always willing to come back and answer more questions. I hope that was useful to the team, and you know, if there's more, you know, more questions, you know, I'm always willing and able to come back. So,
awesome. Do you want me to send you an invite for generally 2 weeks from now?
Yeah, we'll have to see if I, you know, if I, we'll see if I can come, but I'd love to see what he says for sure.
Okay. Thank you, Nicolas. Right. Back to you, Dr. Burton.
Yes. If you'd like to. Thank you so much. We had an awesome time. Yeah, obviously, we had a lot of interested folks in what you had to say today, so it was really great for you to be here. And we definitely will put you back on the schedule so you can come back and talk to us again. I'm sure life will completely change in the next 6 months or so, but we'll love to hear the update from you. And then thanks, everyone.
Absolutely.
I'll post the recording and I'll send you the link too if you want to see that. I'll also send out a feedback survey in a couple of days and give you those results. So very much appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Picard.
Have a good day.
Everyone have a great day. Thank you so much. Bye, guys.